TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Behind the scenes of the Millennium Meeting, the state of global human rights. The United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted in 1948. But the discrepancy between the right to due process in a court of law, to freedom of movement, the right to be free of arbitrary arrest, free from slavery and torture, are today more tentative than ever. Vandana Shiva from India says that globalization and the World Trade Agreement have limited each and every one of those rights just mentioned and more. Shiva is the highly respected physicist, author, and activist who marches with the peasants of India against the invasion of bioengineered seeds. And she is the prominent voice of the South against the WTO. She spoke at the counter teach-in to the UN Millennium Meeting in New York. The International Forum on Globalization had organized the meeting to raise the question what course to take towards the United Nations. The leadership of the UN under Kofi Annan openly collaborates with globalization and corporations, while branches and sub-agencies of the UN blame globalization for increased inequity, rising poverty, and the collapse of human rights. Vandana Shiva began her talk with an appeal to rescue and reform the United Nations that are seen in the South as part of an international system that has the potential to be a countervailing power to the dominance of the rich industrialized nations. Vandana Shiva.
So many of us have been able to connect internationally because of the kind of processes thrown up by the UN system, the Rio process being one of them, the women's movement. The entire human rights movement wouldn't exist without the Human Rights Convention, the environmental movement. It is the platform which teaches us the politics of being global citizens. We've gone over both why the UN needs to be protected from itself and from the corporate takeover, because we all need it. We all need an international system that is responsive to people. We all need the WHOs that created the international accountability of the pharmaceutical industry in the 80s. Out of it was born the Health Action International, the International People's Health Coalition. We need the FAO in the form, not the form that sold pesticides and fertilizers to the third world, but we do need FAO in the form that created the Plant Genetic Resources Commission, which became the place from which the entire struggle for biodiversity, intellectual property, patenting was born, what was called the Seed Wars during the 80s. RAFI, the Rural Advancement Fund International, which is our best information source on the biotech industry, its reason for being is the FAO, Plant Genetic Resource Commission. And in fact, it went so far that one, you know, Gary Fowler, who's co-author with Pat Mooney with books like Shattering and The Laws of Life, was actually appointed to head the entire conference in 1995 on plant genetic resources, which gave us the information that showed exactly how rapid the erosion was, how the power over genetic resources was shifting from people and third world farmers into the hands of corporations. We've seen in this past decade this amazing tug of war where on the one hand, off and on, UN instruments, UN institutions create space for people. They created the space through the Convention on Biological Diversity of a lot of the work I do. If we hadn't got Article 8J into the convention or Article 19.3 on biosafety, we wouldn't have a platform to stand on internationally to contain the excesses of the World Trade Organization and to contain the excesses of the global corporations. And it's precisely that potential of being a countervailing force that makes the UN system so important to us. Two, 3 years ago, when everyone was celebrating 50 years of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and here we were all being absolutely rolled over by WTO and GATT, my sister, who's a doctor and a health activist, and I just decided one evening at home to play around with the two treaties, with the two principles. And I'd like to just share with you what this contest is about by just going over some of the principles. Article 1 of the Human Declaration: all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. We didn't have We Do then. So they said, what does the WTO GATT give us? Basically says all human beings are born unequal and their rights are shaped totally by their ownership of capital. They are not endowed with reason. You need the computer thing to think for you. Article 3, everyone has a right to life, liberty, and security of person. The WTO and GATT basically says, no, you don't. And everything that comes in the way is protectionism that needs to be dismantled. 6, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. We heard earlier this evening about how the only real person in law in WTO is the corporation. We are no more persons. All are equal before the law and entitled without any discrimination to equal protection of the law. All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination. Throughout the WTO treaties, you have discrimination built in. If you are a third world producer, you have absolutely no rights. If you happen to be a global corporation in the same sector, all the rights. If you happen to be a third world person with knowledge, you cannot protect your knowledge. But if you happen to be a corporation like W.R. Grace or Rice Tech and can pirate knowledge from the third world, then you have all the protection to treat the pirated knowledge as your creation and your intellectual property. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile. That's 9. You can have arbitrary arrest on the laws that are coming out of TRIPS. Just walk right in. You have now intellectual property rights police being created across the world who can walk in and check if your software was bought originally from Microsoft or you copied it from a friend. Who can walk into your homes and check whether the seed on your farm has been saved from last year's harvest or it was bought this year. There's this thing about fair and public hearing, independent, impartial tribunals. WTO basically says, no, we'll make decisions secretly behind closed doors, and no one has any right to change that. Everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty according to the law in a public trial at which they have had all the guarantees necessary for their defense. No one shall be held guilty of any penal offense on account of any act or omission which did not constitute a penal offense, etc. The WTO rules on intellectual property basically have reversed the burden of proof. You are guilty. You are not treated innocent until proven guilty. You are treated as guilty of piracy the moment a corporation announces it. And the burden of proof is on you. Acts such as sharing seeds and knowledge will be redefined as crimes, and they will be redefined from being civic violations to being criminal offenses. And the penalty rates, you just have to see the rates in the laws that are being shaped, that they are way beyond any economic justice. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with their privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon their honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to the protection of law against such interference of attack. Everything about the new economy, whether it is information technologies or it is biotechnologies and patents, is about invasion into the privacy of your life, your home. Everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state, and everyone has a right to leave any country. According to the new world of globalization, corporations will have the right to total mobility across the world, not people. The poor will be dispossessed from their homes and villages to make way for corporate investment, and will be denied the right to residence within their own countries. which is happening on such a large scale. They will also not have the right to leave their country, and the military powers of the rich countries will be mobilized to prevent GATT refugees of the third world countries from entering Fortress Europe and Fortress USA. If you see some of the new reports on security, you can see again and again how defense of the market, while opening up borders for capital mobility, also requires new security mobilization for prevention of people entering these so-called free borders. And what's happening to the Mexican border after NAFTA and free trade is a very, very good example. Article 15 of the Human Rights Convention basically says everyone has a right to a nationality and no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of their nationality. GATT basically says people do not really have a right to nationality since such a right discriminates against foreign corporations and violates the principle of national treatment, which is built right in there. And global corporations can have nationality everywhere, which means citizens immediately become second-class citizens in their own countries. Everyone has a right to property, and no one will be arbitrarily deprived of their property. Right? Only corporations have a right to property, and new forms of property in life, in genes, in water, in the very resources which make life possible. And others can be arbitrarily deprived of their seeds, their plants, their biodiversity, and their water resources. Just a few months ago, with the privatization of water starting in India, Coca-Cola has been assigned a lake, and it is preventing the tribal women whose lake it is from collecting drinking water. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinions and expressions. These rights include freedom to hold opinions without interference, to receive and impart information and ideas through any media regardless of frontiers. That is now an intellectual property crime. I could go on in making the comparison about how you're supposed to be able to have the right to elect your governments, and the governments are supposed to have an obligation to represent the will of the people. But what we have instead is governments representing the will of corporations, and the international body of governments, which is the United States, also increasingly being twisted to represent the will of the corporations rather than the people. I want to quickly share with you how concretely this is starting to happen in the area of food and biodiversity. We've seen over the last few months, an attempt to undo all the gains made in the Convention on Biological Diversity by pushing even harder the implementation of the Intellectual Property Rights Agreement of the WTO. A law under review shouldn't have to be implemented at national level, but everywhere countries are being given deadlines of implementation. Genetic engineering and biosafety, we eventually have a biosafety protocol, but around the world, what laws exist are being dismantled. And I say very often that not only are we getting the risks of genetic pollution, we're actually getting the risks of a political pollution where our systems are no more independent of corporate control. Neither are national systems nor the international system of the UN. The thing that really got me very, very annoyed was to find out during distribution of relief after a cyclone in Orissa that much of the relief was genetically engineered corn and soya. And then I started to look more, and we find out that the World Food Program, which is the world's biggest food aid program, buys about 2 million tons of grain from the US to distribute to the people who are supposed to be hungry. All of that now is genetically engineered corn and soya. Going into rice-eating cultures, going without states regulating the import. We've had huge ruckus after the release of our test results in our parliament. And I would suggest we should really focus on preventing the World Food Program, which is supposed to use public money to provide food to the hungry, should not end up becoming a public subsidy to biotech corporations that are otherwise failing on the market calculus. President Clinton, when he came to India in March, formed the CEO's Council. You know, he always Your presidents always fly with airplane loads of businessmen. Ours never used to do that. But now they've started too. And we're suddenly getting the UN not just being hijacked to the compact, but by becoming the platform not for citizens to mobilize, but for CEOs to make deals. And, you know, it breaks my heart to see the release from the CII, the Indian Industry Association, saying the advantages we have and why we need the CEO meeting is they can exploit us better. Yeah? We have abundant availability of skilled and technical manpower in India. That's why we are privileged. We have a huge pool of English-speaking workforce. We have a virtual 12-hour time difference, which makes it magical for information technologies. We can do all the slave labor for the new economy. Nothing about the culture of compassion of Buddha and Gandhi. Nothing about 3/4 of India being practitioners of ultimate eco-friendly technologies in agriculture, handicrafts, handlooms. That's not a compact advantage for the rest of the world. There is, in this release, a statement at the end saying the business linkages to be established during the CEO's meeting on the 7th would be the single most important factor which would determine the future of the Indo-US relationships. I believe it is work we do together as citizens that will determine the future of relationships between my country and yours, between the North and the South, and for people across the planet, including the future of the UN. Thank you.
That was Vandana Shiva from India. She's a physicist, feminist, and philosopher of science. She played a key role in the popular Chipko movement of indigenous women to protect forests in the Himalayas. She received the 1993 Right Livelihood Award that is often called the Alternative Nobel Prize. Her most recent book is Stolen Harvest. She spoke in September of 2000 in New York at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization. The next speaker is Phyllis Bennis. She works with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and directs their programs on the United Nations and the Middle East. Phyllis Bennis.
Most of us come to this question, the question that brings us here today, out of our understanding of the dangers of corporations, the dangers that they pose to people and to nations across the world. I would pose that the United Nations has been as much a victim of corporate influence and corporate control as any other sector of our societies. Recently, it's been probably almost as much a victim of corporate control as it has been a victim of U.S. domination for so many years. In today's world, where national power, national sovereignty in so many countries other than this one, and certainly democracy, are under attack, are diminishing, are threatened, we have to look at what replaces national sovereignty and democracy and national rights around the world. What we see is a parallel from the 1970s when the Keynes model of economic formations was replaced to a large degree by what became the Washington Consensus, the dominance of the international financial institutions driven by corporate interests and designed to reflect those corporate interests, the IMF and the World Bank, now the WTO, of course, being primary among them. And in that same period, the U.S. began its major attacks on the United Nations, which had become the central point of decolonization throughout the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And that period of attacking the UN, of course, culminated in 1985 during the Reagan administration when the U.S. stopped paying its dues. The U.S. hasn't been paying its dues at the UN since 1985 because the Reagan administration believed a Heritage Foundation report that said they would have more power and more influence if they owed the most money but didn't pay it. Because then everyone else would think, if we just make one more concession, if we just give them one more piece of what they want, maybe they'll do it. So you keep saying, oh yes, we just need, we just need, we just need, and you don't pay it anyway. So you get the best of both worlds. And we have, of course, then Jesse Helms himself, who has taken the lead on this issue. And he said recently, another one of these amazing quotes, this is what he told the UN Security Council when he was invited to address the council. He said, quote, "The American people will not accept the authority of any supranational institution as being greater than the sovereign right of Americans to decide how to act in their own interest, both at home and abroad." Don't you wish we had the right to decide in our sovereign interests at home and abroad, rather than Shell and Rio Tinto and Nike? The United Nations has been the victim of this seizure of power. What I think we need is a new kind of internationalism, not isolation, not interventionism, but a new kind of internationalism that challenges the corporate-driven globalization process that now passes for international relations in the world. And the U.S. is the key enemy of that internationalism. And through its corporations, and in the intersection between U.S. strategic policies and corporate interests, we see the greatest threat to the possibilities of creating a real internationalism that links peoples rather than capital and money issues across borders. So how does that happen? No nation can do it alone. No nation can challenge it alone. The French talk the talk sometimes about, they call the U.S., you know, these days the hyperpower. And they talk about how that's a danger. Cuba walks the walk in challenging U.S. hegemony, but no nation can do it alone. We need new kinds of coalitions between some countries sometimes, coalitions of our organizations, of people's organizations, that are designed to protect the environment and protect workers' rights, stop the exploitation of child labor, the whole range of women's organizations, peace organizations, particularly aimed at the corporations who produce the weapons of mass destruction around the world. You know, we hear a lot about how the U.S. is so concerned about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. We don't hear very much about the U.S. Commerce Department licensing U.S. corporations to send to Iraq the seed stock for creating those weapons throughout the 1970s, 80s, and just ending on the eve of the war in 1991. We need new accountability, and we have to demand it from the United Nations with a new demand for transparency and participation. We start by saying, yes, civil society has a right to be in the room, that this isn't acceptable to have governments meeting behind closed doors, but it's not enough for us either to just be in the room. We have to have a voice, so that when we talk about transparency, we're talking about participation, not just watching through a transparent wall. We have good examples of where civil society and NGOs and transnational movements played a very key role in creating new kinds of international laws. The International Criminal Court that has come into being without the United States, the landmine conventions without the United States, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, that should be a no-brainer, that the U.S. has not signed and ratified. All of these have come into being despite, not because, of the United States. And all of them brought together groups of countries that shifted around. Different countries were involved in different ones. But most important, all involved civil society, too. Human rights organizations and environmental organizations and women's organizations. And we managed to win some victories. We made rape a war crime for the first time in history. We were part of a movement that got Pinochet arrested and held accountable for the first time. And no, it's not a victory that's complete. It won't be complete until Henry Kissinger is in the dock with him. But it's a beginning. It's a beginning. And we have the United Nations playing a very key role in some of these efforts. We see the subcommission of the UN's Human Rights Commission issuing a devastating report on the WTO and how it damages human rights internationally. That's very important, and we need to encourage that. We have other examples, though, where we have failed. We have failed to stop the United States from using the United Nations as a shield to justify unilateral wars in Iraq and elsewhere. We failed to stop the United States from sidelining the United Nations and going instead to NATO to go to war in Yugoslavia over Kosovo. And we have failed to prevent the inappropriate partnerships with some pretty inappropriate corporations. But we're on our way. And I think it's very important that we keep in mind a framework that says we are on the same side as what the United Nations is. We are the ones reclaiming it from the distortion and the attack and the victimization of the UN caused by the United States. And I think when we talk about redeeming the legacy of the UN, it's not going to be easy. U.S. domination of the UN is an old story. It goes back to the days when the UN was first being created, and the CIA had a secret operation that was called Operation Ultra, where they were wiretapping every delegation of the 50 delegations that came to San Francisco to negotiate the treaty to create the United Nations in 1945. They already were wiretapping them back then. It's an amazing story. This isn't a new story, but it's taken on a new danger, because now we have the UN under attack not only by U.S. domination, but by corporate domination as well. And it's up to us to reclaim the United Nations and to make real the commitments of the Charter. We have to rebuild people's sovereignty in this era where national sovereignty has been slashed, national power has been destroyed, or faces serious threats around the world by corporations and by U.S. domination. It seems to me that the world has had enough of empires, and we and the UN together are going to have to challenge it. Thank you.
That was Phyllis Bennis. She directs the programs on the United Nations and the Middle East at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. A former radio journalist, she's the author of Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's United Nations. And she is the co-editor of Altered States, A Reader in the New World Order. This is the second-to-last program in an 8-part series on the complicity of the leadership of the United Nations with globalization and corporations. It was recorded in September of 2000 in New York at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization. You will hear from David Corton in next week's program. You can get Vandana Shiva and Phyllis Bennis on a 1-hour tape for $12. The transcript of this full 4-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE and let us know if you want the transcript or the tape or both. That's 1-877-TUC-TAPE. Or send you a $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.